So Mark, now we kind of switching gear. We've been talking about gravitational waves until now, but photons still exist in the universe, even though we've detected gravitational waves. And Marcus is going to tell us about how you can use effective field theory to understand observations of event horizon telescopes.
Thanks. Thanks very much for the invitation. So basically, you have all seen this picture of the event horizon telescope.
So you've all seen this famous picture, and the main conclusion of the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration is that with all the information they can extract from this picture, or you know, they don't actually record that picture, but that's what they generate from the data, is that this looks like GR. So the first order statement is it doesn't look like anything crazy, new physics. You know, like maybe if you had a perfectly reflecting surface, you would just have a disk that fills the entire thing, but there is this dark region in the middle. Within some errors, this looks like GR. And so we should be able to constrain everything that we've talked about in terms of echoes for gravitational waves. We should also be able to constrain these reflection coefficient kind of related phonologies for photons from this picture, from the fact that it already looks like GR and not like anything beyond GR. So basically, I'm just going to use the same framework that Cliff presented this morning. And the only thing that's really going to change in terms of the formalism, I'm not going to go much into the formalism, but is that instead of a Klein-Gordon field, we have photons, right? So a vector field. And instead of solving the Tarkovsky equation for the Klein-Gordon field, like Cliff did, you can do the Tarkovsky equation also includes the spin one field. So you can just use that whole formalism that we've already established to constrain theories in this EFT sense. So again, this is not looking at a particular your favorite UV theory, but it's like looking at these generally parameterized EFTs with the same kind of constraints. So this epsilon, where we impose the boundary condition, is small compared to the actual horizon size, and with the caveat that the actual set of UV theories that match onto this might actually be empty. But you know, if it's not, then it's general. So. Right, so in terms of the structure of the talk, I'll just quickly review what's relevant from the event horizon observations for this, and then discuss how, briefly summarize how the near horizon EFT is exploited here, and then go to the actual method in terms of using the data we use and the results. So the event horizon telescope is the combination of all these different observatories, and the fact that they are so far away from each other, this creates these large baselines for an interferometer, which basically makes it a telescope of the size of the Earth, more or less. And then there is variation in these baselines, which is just caused by the rotation of the Earth relative to whatever you're observing. And that basically fills out this plot here. So everything that is colored, that is actually been observed. Whereas the white regions, these combinations of frequencies have not actually been observed. So the important thing here is that these telescopes, they don't see distance, they see frequency, right? So if you actually want to get to a picture, like the picture that's so famous for the event horizon telescope, that's in distance. So if you want to go from the frequencies to the distance, you have to do a Fourier transformation. And basically what you're doing is you're Fourier transforming this frequency picture to the actually intensity as a function of angular coordinates picture. And if you, in a perfect world where you would cover all possible baselines, you would fill out this plot and it would just be a, you know, a calculation and you'd be done and there would be no ambiguity what the picture looked like and that would be it, right? But the reality is that this plot is only filled out in certain regions. And so there is actually some fitting involved. What's that?
You need UV
completion. Yeah, so there is actually some fitting involved and I'm just gonna show some pictures and that's kind of why these pictures look slightly different. So these are three different methods that the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration uses. So they just have these like kind of random names, DiffMap, EHD imaging, and SMEELY. And you see, so there are these 4-day observations where they actually had all the telescope time at the same time and all the locations at the same time. And you can see that the pictures look slightly different. So that's kind of one big takeaway here. It's like, it's not that they always look exactly the same. There is something that is very common, which is that there is a brightness depressed region in the middle. There is this like intensity more towards the south west region as opposed to the northeast region being darker. And the size of this the ring is similar in all imaging methods. And that's why the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration is confident that this does not depend on how they reconstruct the image, because they do it different ways and so on. And
so if you were to not make a model but do something rather simple, for example, you spread say 16 Gaussians on there on a grid or some other structure, and then just determine the amplitudes, what would come out? Would that be significantly worse than that?
I don't know. I mean, that's the, how do you mean like Gaussians? So for like a ring structure or?
Split the plane up into 16 pixels.
Yeah.
You just get the amplitude, but the pixels have the sharp edges. So you do something else to make sure you're not getting sharp edges there.
Yeah.
And what would that look like?
Yeah, I don't know. I think you have to ask them.
You see some high resolution in these spots and some of these images.
Yeah.
You don't see it in others. So it seems to be an artifact of the model. Some models prefer tiny bright spots and others prefer large regions and so on.
I mean, to be fair to them, that is true, but they come up with these image characteristics that we're discussing later, and they just have some errors, you know? So maybe the region will be, where the brightest spot is, will be like slightly different in the southwest region, but that's where then these errors come from.
Yeah.
And that,
my idea
yeah.
would be, I want to get an intuition how much the model influences the reconstructed image. Would you just get a blob of noise if you don't have a model, or does the model just improve it by 50%?
Yeah, I think they do some of these kind of things where they just throw like noise and see what that their model is or that their reconstruction method is.
Without model, you want to reconstruct with a rather simple model, just have an image plane and that's it.
I don't know.
Okay. So you think they put in something else?
No, the idea is that these are all models you set from the models depending on the parameters that you have. But I want a model basically without any parameters. So you take this plane and you decompose it into 16 pixels or whatever, 64 pixels, something rather coarse. And then you constrain the pixel values. And of course, just chopping up the plane, I mean, maybe squares, hexagons, you choose what you want to do. And what would the image look like then? And so without the model, would you still see something? In how far? This is just.
But so are you saying in frequency space you're doing that and then you're transforming, or what are you doing? I don't know.
Doesn't matter. It's just a basis transformation that you do. But I want to be model independent. I want to do something rather simple.
I think that visualization you're talking about is still a model, right?
Yes. But it's a model that is not influenced by physics.
I don't think any of these models are perfect. I mean, they are.
I thought they were.
I mean, that's a step when they extrapolate what the masses are and things like that. And that's when they compare to these.
So you're saying these models are independent of physics? They're just basic image reconstruction? If you throw it at a low resolution image of a cat, you will get a cat out? Or can you? Then does the model only work for black holes?
I think there are some subtleties, yeah. I'm not sure. Like there is this modeling. Definitely if you want to extrapolate the mass of the black hole, they do the whole shebang with the
No.
You know, but just for the image reconstruction, I'm not sure exactly how little the assumptions are. Yeah, it's an interesting question.
Because when they give it that stuff, and we get it back. In fact, we add the hole and they don't get the hole.
Yeah, they do some sanity thing checks. So
yeah,
what you mentioned for sure.
You get a ring with a bright spot and a hole or not, then essentially you just have that you really constrain things. And then if the data wouldn't fit the model at all,
So this is actually like a combined picture of all the three methods, which looks pretty similar. And you see that also in terms of time, it looks pretty much the same, which of course depends on what's exactly like falling in, how active is the supermassive black hole at that moment when you're taking the picture. And just for scale, like it's just really impressive, I think, that so these are 10 microarc seconds. So these things are like so far away that tens of microarc seconds, that means that the distance that you're resolving compared to the distance how far it is actually 10 orders of magnitude, right? Which is pretty impressive, I think. Those are the kind of things we're resolving here. And then these are these image diagnostics. So the diameter, that's kind of the ring with peak brightness. That's what they define as the diameter. The width is like where the, you know, full width, half maximum, subtracting some background is in terms of distance. And then you have the orientation angle, which is basically where this peak brightness in the ring is. So that's always somewhere in the southwest. And then you have the azimuthal asymmetry. Basically, think about that as like that's zero if the ring is perfectly homogeneous, and it's one if the brightness is concentrated in one for one angle, like a delta function. The things that we'll actually be exploiting is the fractional central brightness. So that is how much intensity is in the central ring, like what they call here Rin, compared to what's in between R in and R out. That less, and the mostly we'll be relying on the deviation from circularity. So that really is the standard deviation of the measurement of the diameter divided by the value of the diameter itself.
So what did the eta point to? That was the eta was the direction orientation angle to what?
Of the ring. So it's kind of where you would have the the expectation value for brightness multiplying angle. If you would have all brightness at one angle, then that would be eta. If you would have one angle at 270, one at 180, get all the intensity there, then you would be in between those angles.
Oh, so the fact that your blue thing is pointing down and the brightest thing is to the left is because there's these other two blobs.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not there because there's this stuff here too that moves us a bit over there. Yeah. So we don't. So I should say the whole point of this exercise is to get like a quick and dirty estimate on what does this already constrain, and do this before you actually do the kind of proper analysis. So we want to see what can we do with little effort before to see the potential of this method before you would implement this fully into the general relativistic magnetohydraulic simulations and so on, right? So we're not actually using their data. We're not part of the coloration or anything. So we're just digitizing their image. So this is what the, you know, quick and dirty digitized image looks like, basically. You can still see the diameter and the width of the ring.
What do you mean by digital?
You take the plot out of the paper, and you know, and they give you a temperature scale, and then you just digitally read that in.
So you just took a JPEG file. And
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that does this like you can download this like data feed or something?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, you know, you'll see, like, we're basically we're losing a 2 to 3 times at two to, like, our if we run the same diagnostics that they run on our digitized image, it's like 2 or 3 times as bad as them. So you see here, like, the error on the diameter is 7 as opposed to 2.6, 7.4 as opposed to 2.6, and so on. For the angle, we cannot constrain that. It gets too bad, but everything else is kind of in that range. And we're just doing an order of magnitude here, right? So for our first thing, that's totally fine. And right, when we actually compare physics, so we'll make pictures that don't just come from GR, but they come from you know, modified gravity theories in this EFT sense. Then we compare these pictures to what these diagnostics are for the actual picture to see if they're excluded or not. And it turns out that the deviation from circularity, which is delta C, and the fractional central brightness, which is how much brightness depression there is in the center, that those are actually the most constraining, and all these other ones, they don't, at our errors, we can't use them to constrain stuff. Okay, and so if you look at the EHT bound, so they basically say deviation from circularity is less than 10%. And if you look at their value, then you see, so it's 2.6 divided by 40, so that's more like 5%. But basically they run a bunch of different scenarios, and they're just being, and every time they get a different, slightly different bound, right? So they're just being conservative by saying, okay, we don't really know exactly here what the confidence levels are, so let's just say it's like 10% is a conservative. If you look at, they never cite any confidence for that. If you look at their plots, this would be like 95%, okay? Something like that, but they don't give you a number. Yeah. 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 It's like. Right. So since our errors are worse, we're taking 20%. You know, which is about what we find for. It's a bit less than what we find, but we just have one image. We don't have all these different pipelines that we can do statistics on, right? So to get a good estimate for what's constrained or not, we take 20%. And then 0.7 is what we get. This is like the fractional central brightness is a much more iffy parameter than the deviation from circularity, because it's very sensitive to what the foreground is or not. And you see these values depending on the imaging methods. So this is just these three rows are just their data. You see that varies everything between 10 to minus 6 and 10 to minus 2. So that value is really not like, you know, don't take that too serious. But this one is more robust, and that's basically what all our constraints are relying on. Right. Okay, so that's, so yeah, in terms of what to take away from this is basically we have a digitized image. It's 2 times, 3 times worse than what the EHT collaboration has in terms of what we can constrain with it. And that a property, standard deviation of diameter divided by diameter, is the one that we're actually going to use to constrain other theories. Right. So so this docks on to what Cliff said. So we have some kind of effective action on the horizon that is exactly like what we discussed this morning, except for this field phi now is some vector mode as opposed to a Klein-Gordon field. And it's the same logic that Cliff already discussed, you know, this coupling H1, which is the lowest order non-GR physics, has some dependence on epsilon, which is where you impose this boundary condition. And then the actual reflection coefficient which is C minus over C plus, is not a quantity that cannot depend on the cutoff, so you have to impose this RG condition that the derivative with respect to epsilon is zero. And what all that, like you go through the algorithm, and what that leads you to is that the reflection coefficient that is an experimental observable is basically some number Rn times something RuV. This number Rn is like you need the kind of the whole solution of the bulk field, but it's has nothing to do with the EFT. It's just some number that you got to find. And then the RuV part is captured in this formula, and L is an RG invariant scale. Zeta, again, just doing a Schwarzschild limit here. In the paper, we're doing Kerr, obviously. In the Schwarzschild limit, this is like this. So basically, you can think about it that if you measure R, or if you constrain R, and you know what Rn is, then you can constrain what this RG invariant scale actually is, which is a proxy for your EFT physics. Right. So in practice, what we do...
So is your pointer working? Or?
Yeah, it is. I'm just confused. No, the laser pointer is working, but when you point it at the screen, I can see it, so I don't know.
It looks like you're
pointing. Yeah, no, like you see it here, but then you don't see it there.
I see, yeah, that's not the best.
Right, so there could also be some angular dependence to the reflection coefficient on top of some energy dependence. So we're not taking into account energy dependence, and we're also not taking into account angular. So for angular dependence, we're doing a multiple expansion, and we're going from up to the second order in angular dependence, and we will constrain each of these three scenarios. And that is basically, for everything we do, we impose a reflection coefficient at this surface that is slightly outside of the horizon. Epsilon is small with respect to epsilon. And then R0 is the RG invariant, which, as we discussed in the previous slide, is a proxy for this RG scale L that we're actually constraining. So how does this work in practice? So this is kind of the whole ray tracing. How do we impose this reflection surface in practice? So say the telescope is at 10 here, and you know it's computationally much easier to just trace back all the possible lines that have come to the telescope as opposed to starting with everything that is pointing at the black hole and seeing what ends up at your telescope. So you just do everything backwards in time. That's a much more efficient way to go about it. And so what happens is in pure GR, this black trajectory would have just fallen into, or would have never come because it comes from kind of inside the horizon. The green ring is the photon ring. The red ring is the reflection surface. So what can happen is that a photon comes from here, gets reflected, actually comes out of the photon ring, and you see it, and you think it would have come from here. So, and then that can happen various different ways, right? So it could also be that it goes into the photon ring, gets reflected here, and comes to you. Or it actually comes from behind you, gets reflected, comes to you. Right, and so this is related to how we actually do this. So all we really have is the picture, and we have that there is a reflection surface at some epsilon plus RH where the rays are reflected. So all we really need is that information from the original picture and the ray tracing algorithm, including the reflection. So as you saw in the previous plots, when we have these photons that come to us from being reflected at the surface, we need to assign some kind of intensity to them if we want to know how the picture changes, right? So how do we do that? Basically, the first step is to just trace back all the pixels of the original image to a surface close to the black hole, so for instance, the photon ring, and then we know where these photons came from, right? So we have a surface around a black hole, and each point we can associate an intensity to, because that's where that pixel that we see in the telescope has ended up, right? So it's just a map, like just think about mapping the 2D picture to a surface around a black hole, right? So in the second step, now we turn on the reflection. So now when we look into all these photons that can also end up at the telescope, they will pass through that map that we have created, right? So this guy, for instance, here, so this guy will have gone through the map here and here. So whichever photon, maybe it was, I don't know, like this photon or so that went there, we know what intensity to assign to this photon that ended up here. And if you think about it in this map, so the black ones are the how we created this original map, and then the red ones are all the photons that have been reflected. So we just assign to them the closest point on that surface that we have. And then we get a picture of reflected intensities, and then we just add that to the original picture, and then we get how the picture has been modified, right?
This is like the key assumption that you're making, and you're assuming that all the emission comes from a surface, right?
Yeah, so it's like...
And then have you tried changing that surface and see what...
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the procedure, and as you rightly point out, there's definitely a few caveats to this. So first of all, if you are adding this picture and you're inferring the intensity from the original picture, then you're already assuming that this has to be a perturbative thing, because you can't, if the original, you need to know what the original picture looked like. So to first order, it looks like GR. And that's why that assumption is justified. Yeah, if we got some picture and we wouldn't know what to do with it, then this approach will not work. Like some picture that wouldn't look like GR that the EHT has given us, we wouldn't know what to do with that. The other thing is the photons pass through this whole accretion region, and if we just assign an intensity somewhere, then we have to assume that the photon doesn't change its energy, its direction as it passes through that. So the accretion disk has to be optically thin, but that's also discussed in length in the Event Horizon Telescope papers. That is actually something that seems to be true in this particular environment for M87. So their simulations are also using that it's an optically thin medium. And then lastly, that the reference surface has to radiate with equal intensity in all directions. Because you know the photons pass through that surface in different angles. And if we don't assume that, then we don't know which direction it'll point to. Right. So here are some of the images that you get. So you know, I said that it's perturbative. So kind of the last row, r equals 0.4 and 1. Those are more like for illustrative purposes. But you see how the original picture, this basically looks like the original picture. And you can already tell by eye that that's probably cannot constrain it better than this. And then you see how the picture changes. Mostly there is just more intensity focus into the central region, because that's where those rays that are coming parallel, all the rays are basically parallel since it's so far away. They come from this kind of region that without reflection we couldn't access. Right, and this was L equals zero, so reflection independent surface, and then this is L equals one, so you see it looks slightly different. Not too different by eye, L equals two. Right, and then just the fact that the deviation from circularity is not allowed to be 0.2, larger than 0.2, allows us to put these constraints, right? So on these modified images, we just run these diagnostics and compare all these parameters, but the restrictive one turns out to be delta C, and delta C gives us these constraints. So this is L equals zero. So you see our zero is constrained to be somewhere between you know, 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 1. So, you know, that's kind of probably what you would have expected, that these observations constrain these reflection coefficients to be somewhere between 1 and 10%, right? Already. With like, you know, nothing really sophisticated. And then the fractional central brightness is only constraining for much larger values of R that are almost close to 1. One thing is we don't actually know what the spin of the M87 black hole is. So we're doing the same thing as the Event Horizon Telescope, where we're just, you know, doing a scan over values between minus 0.94 and 9.4. It's not entirely true. Zero is technically excluded because, but from a kind of mixed experimental theoretical point of view, because then if there's no spin, there's no way to power the jet that we know of. So that's kind of excluded. But from all the EHT observations, they can't actually put any handle on what the spin of the black hole is. Right, and these plots look more or less the same for the higher multiples. They actually get less restrictive because, as you see, if you have a sine theta and a cosine theta, then there's more zeros where the reflection coefficient becomes zero anyways. So it's naturally less excluding for higher multiples. Yeah, so that's the conclusions. So the important thing is that the event horizon observations are consistent with GR, as claimed in their analysis. And so that was our idea, that we could then do a quick and dirty estimate to constrain in this framework of gravity EFTs. And what we find is that something between 1 and 10% is already excluded. So, you know, it's like this parameter H1 is different for every bulk field. So there's a H1 for the Klein-Gordon field. There's an H1 for the electromagnetic field. So if you rely on an H1 of 1 for your echoes, then that might be fine. And this is just telling you that the H1 for electromagnetic modes is less than 0.1. So it's not directly excluding it, but it gives you some estimate. Yeah, and then the right way to do this is to, first of all, use their data, right? The real data that would bring down the errors and the sensitivity by a factor 2 to 3 right away. And then also to just include this in their simulations. And basically, these GRMHD simulations are ray tracing plus magnetohydrodynamics, right? And probably the ray tracing is the least complicated part in these simulations. So all you would really have to add to their simulations is that you put, you know, varying reflection coefficients, the surface where the rays are reflected, and then you look at what these pictures are. And then you compare that to the actual data. That would be the right way to do this. And then you would probably bring down these bounds by, you know, I don't know how many factors, but 2 to 3 times X. Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much.
Wonderful. Interesting question for Marcus. Yes, please. Two questions. One, what was the motivation to put error dependence on the reflectivity? And doesn't that break the symmetries of the care spacetime?
The motivation is just that no angular dependence would be the most vanilla case, you know? And I mean, there's like, you can go arbitrarily complicated in angular and energy dependence, and we just wanted to have some handle on the angular dependence. And it breaks the Kerr symmetry, but also we're not in GR anymore, right? So I don't think that matters.
But Kerr has theta dependence in it, so I would say.
Theta, but she puts phi dependence as well.
No.
No?
No, just theta dependence.
Oh.
Oh, that. Oh, see, I have what you mean. No. Okay, so no, we are just as theta dependence. Yeah.
See.
I thought you meant the same theta dependence as Kerr, but okay.
No. But have you looked into frequency dependent reflectivities?
No. No, not yet.
There's one frequency only available, right?
Right.
You just have one.
So, another, so is there a model up there that you actually built up?
Well, maybe not. I don't know.
Well, that's going to be the topic of next talk. So, right. We just got to talk about the models. Yeah. So,
but like the reflection coefficient is pretty good handle, right? In terms of what such a theory would lead to, right?
Well, the question is whether you should be equating photons with graviton reflections.
Yeah, we're not, right?
No,
it's a separate parameter, but.
So if you're not, then what do you love?
Yeah, I think that.
Let me
ask that question, is there a model that makes any predictions at all?
A model that makes normal matter will obviously absorb photons, but not necessarily gravity.
If I knew how quantum gravity worked, I'd know that.
I think we have an answer for that, but I think we should just wait a couple of minutes to get a model.
Alright.
But Max, I have a question about Eric.
How long does it take for an echo to ring down? Milliseconds, minutes. But the new observations would, yes, but the new observation for the larger
sorry.
You will have a time scale of minutes. So if the echo rings down in a longer time scale,
yeah.
Then doing this instantaneous approximation with the ray tracing might be wrong. Then you're looking at the picture, but you see an echo for something that happened minutes ago.
But I mean, this thing doesn't
so,
very much in days, right? I mean, you are.
This one doesn't because the time scale is days.
Yeah.
But the next image they're going to take, the time scale will be 10 by 15 minutes. So if the echo time scale is longer, then the analysis becomes more complicated.
Yeah.
Right.
So you could
actually look in echoes kind of in those future observations from them. People.
Yeah, I mean, if you see an echo, you would see an echo that, I don't know, if the current echo takes a second,
yeah.
Would be from a picture that you took an hour ago, because that would be the time scale, depending on if there's
yeah,
mass.
Right,
10
but
to the 9
seconds, right? Because if it's
what,
no, 10 to the, this is 10 to the 9 solar masses, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So if for 100 solar masses, I mean, yeah, I think it would be like, because for 100 solar masses, it would be a second. So for 10 to the 9 solar masses, it would be 10 to the 7 seconds, which is like 3 months or so.
Okay,
so that would be.
So that then you see some outburst, then a year later you would see some.
You
okay,
see
interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you're really lucky.
No, you see the outburst, and then a year later you take another massive measurement and see whether you see the echo of the outburst. And if you do the ray tracing and if you have a light curve, you might even make a prediction of what it looks like.
Yeah. So that's an excellent. Yes, if there is an outburst, and these things do have bursts. I think actually in this, our black hole is more bursty than these because it's like everything takes 1,000 times longer for this guy. But for our black hole to have bursts in the course of days. So then I guess the prediction is if you see a burst and then you're going to see an echo maybe a day, day later or so.
So these like. These time steps between the echoes, don't they depend on, can they be totally different or are they just, are you saying they're just set by the mass or?
They're set by mass and the spin. Now there is some ambiguity, which is kind of what Bob and I kind of disagree. I don't think we quite disagree, but I mean, there's some ambiguity from anything. I mean, new physics is within a Planck length or within a, I guess, 10 to the 10 times Planck length, right? There could be some.
Mm.
That could change it by, I don't know, 10% or 20%. That's But I mean, there's not that much of a room there. Mm. It's mostly dependent on mass. So the question I have for you is, I mean, you had this surface, but then have you tried putting it in different places, or where did you put this surface?
Yeah, so you probably mean...
the surface where you assign...
Yeah. So yeah, we have put that at many different places. Right. So it doesn't make a difference as long as you actually capture the entire picture. So if you make this radius too big, then there's a whole region that you can't access.
I don't understand.
Too big. Because basically all the rays, they so all the rays are parallel as far as like practically speaking, right? Can draw parallel. So if you have the black hole, then you know they would come. So a good surface is the one where you actually get to go here. So your surface is like full. If you put the surface here and your image is only a certain size, right? Then you will only cover like this bit, say. So there's like, there's a range depending on the size in micro arc seconds of your picture close to the photon ring that lets you capture the whole thing. But as long as you're in that range, it doesn't depend on where it is.
But sorry, if you make the surface that big, aren't you violating the assumption that epsilon is small compared to the...
This is not epsilon, this is for the map. So say this is this map to get those photon intensities, and then this is the horizon, and then somewhere here in between is the RH plus epsilon.
So have you changed the position of, have you tried for different epsilons?
For small, close to the horizon, yeah. So remember, epsilon over RH has to be small.
Yeah, but have you tested for different values of
epsilon?
Yes.
Yeah, but small.
And epsilon doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, it's not. It's like, it's not a physical parameter, right? That's the whole point of this whole RG story. That it doesn't matter where you impose your refraction coefficient. It's not really like, it's not that there's two parameters. It's just you pick one EFT representation, say L, that's what you're constraining. That would lead to a certain observable.
Okay, cool. If there are no other questions, let's thank Marcus again.